This is an ABC podcast.
Good afternoon, Nikolai Bailhart's with you for the Country Hour. Today, up to $5 million worth of environmental water is going to be put on the market for irrigators to buy this season. The Victorian Environmental Water Holder, or the VEW as it's also known, has announced that it will be selling the water this week because it's surplus to their needs. But in a year when many irrigators say they don't have enough water, it's a decision that has caused some controversy, so we'll take a look at that issue. Also on the program today, you learn something every day, and today you'll learn that carrots are the big star performer when it comes to Australian vegetable exports. Almost $100 million worth last year. AusVeg has just released data on veggie exports for the past year. It says countries like Singapore, Japan and Thailand have all seen a lot of growth. Interestingly though, China has not. We'll find out why.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
To start today, though, senior Nationals Party members have faced a barrage of angry questions from farmers at Maroopna this early this morning. Amongst the politicians, Damien Drum, David Littleproud and drought envoy Barnaby Joyce. The meeting was initially set up as a drought forum, but questions quickly turned to water and the Murray-Darling Basin plan. Our political reporter Kath Sullivan has been at the meeting and joins us. Kath, what was the mood like there?
G'day, Nikolai. Well, you're absolutely bang on the money there. The meeting was set up in a fruit packing shed just outside of Maroopna today with the intention of discussing drought policy, how it's unfolding in this part of northern Victoria, but also how it can be improved. Yet from the very get-go, the very moment that the local MP, member for Murray, Damien Drum, stood up, it became very clear that irrigators in the room had a bit of venting that they wanted to get off their chest, and absolutely 99% of it all related to water policy.
So what kind of questions were being asked?
Well, there were questions, but there were also a lot of comments. I feel a little bit like Tony Jones on Q&A. We'll take that as a statement, thanks. Voices were raised. You could hear voices shaking as well as irrigators spoke about their personal circumstances. It came to light in the room that something like 3 dairy farmers a week from this region are leaving the land, leaving the industry because of the pressure that a poor commodity price but also high water prices is putting on them. There were lots of statements saying at one stage a fellow yelled out, look, we're happy to have your handouts in terms of drought support, but it doesn't go nearly far enough. What we need is new water policy. A number of irrigators were there using signs that said pause the plan, calling for a pause on the Murray-Darling Basin plan, which I think it's fair to say that not all irrigators would agree with that sentiment, but there was certainly a lot of angst and the feeling that what is happening, the way that this policy, halfway through this plan now, the way that it is rolling out across this part of the Murray-Darling Basin is not working. And I'd say there were about 100 irrigators there, Nikolai. Some of them had travelled from New South Wales, I noticed as well. And I think it's worth pointing out too that a lot of the anger and frustration also related to policy decisions that are made at a state level rather than a federal level. Yet it seemed to be an opportunity where those who were gathered could really get a bit off their chest.
And so what did the politicians say to those statements about those people, for example, calling for a pause on the plan? What kind of response did the politicians have?
Well, I'll just point out a couple of things. This meeting was down to run for about an hour, I think, and it started out in the packing shed. And very quickly it became clear that nobody could hear anybody because of the acoustics. Mm. So the meeting moved to a second spot and it was very hot in direct sun. People were perspiring quite quickly, which perhaps added to the frustration. And so then the meeting moved a third time into the shade of the cool room. And over the period of about an hour and a half, the 3 Nationals MPs stood and listened to the crowd. I feel like they gave everyone a fair hearing. But Water Minister David Littleproud was very clear from the get-go that it is highly unlikely that the Murray-Darling Basin plan will be paused. He made it clear that he didn't think that it was a perfect policy document, but that he was working with what he had essentially and trying to get the best deal. I mean, I think at one stage he made the point, you know, I'm in there swinging for you, trying to represent your interests and your needs. But whether that fell on deaf ears, I'm not sure.
So, and on that, I suppose, does it, so in a sense, does it feel like it could have been an airing of grievances, but where do you go from here?
Exactly. Damien Drumm, the local MP, did offer to meet with those, particularly those calling for a pause on the plan. He asked for those to gather separately after the meeting. I think he's even made an appointment with those groups already so that he can discuss it specifically. There was a sense, a lot of heads shaking, comments to the effect of, they've heard it all before. There's nothing new in what was discussed today, despite commitments from the politicians to take this angst that they were hearing and certainly feeling. I feel like there was a tension that was being relayed or communicated, and there's absolutely no way that the minister and drought envoy Barnaby Joyce could have missed it. And certainly they did commit to take that message back to Canberra, but with an election due to be called shortly, it remains to be seen how that message cuts through at this time.
And just finally, I suppose, on that note too, it is of note that this is an area that has had relatively strong support for the Nationals in the past. So it's interesting that there seems to be some people that aren't so pleased with the party at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. Of course, the seat of Murray, which is to be renamed Nicholls, was taken by the Nationals at the last federal election from the Liberal Party. Probably worth noting that Barnaby Joyce today did make some comments as to the coalition agreement, which he managed to nut out when he was the head of the Nationals with Malcolm Turnbull. And he did make the point, you know, if it's not going to stick up for country people, then the Nats shouldn't sign up to a coalition agreement. I'm not sure if that was a message for his current leader, Michael McCormack. Of course, there's been a little bit of a spotlight on that relationship in recent times. I did get the feeling, while there was also praise for the Victorian Labor Minister, Lisa Neville, for her role in advocating for the communities to date, it didn't feel like it was a political thing. It didn't feel like anybody today was going to change their vote because of what they heard. I might have misread the room on all of that, but it did certainly feel like an opportunity to really vent their frustrations. And in response, David Littleproud did actually say that these were very similar concerns and frustrations that he'd heard right up and down the basin. And you just have to look at the minister's travel plans last week as he was announcing some decentralisation of Murray-Darling Basin authority jobs up and down the basin. He certainly has been in irrigation communities in recent times. And just on the MDBA, one final point, if I could, Nicolai, he did say that he wouldn't be afraid to take the blowtorch to the MDBA if he thought that was needed, and he was happy to hear concerns and or prepared to take grievances on the role of the MDBA. And he said that, you know, I took the blowtorch to my own department, the Agriculture Department, over the Livex issue, and I'd be prepared to do that again. So if I was working at the MDBA, I think my ears might have pricked up a little bit to hear that.
Okay, Kath, thanks so much for the update.
Good on you, Nick.
Kath Sullivan reporting live there from Shepparton. As we've heard, a number of Nationals politicians facing angry questions from farmers in Maroopna earlier this morning, largely to do with the progress of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. It's 13 past 12 here on the Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria, and let's stick with water for the moment. As I mentioned, up to $5 million worth of environmental water is going to be put on the market for irrigators to buy this season. The Victorian Environmental Water Holder, or The View, is selling the water this week because it says it's surplus to its needs. Serena Lowe, the co-executive officer of The View, explains.
We see this as a win-win for the environment and regional communities. The Victorian Environmental Water Holder is going to sell up to 10,000 megalitres of Murray allocation because our most recent demand supply assessment has shown that all our priority environmental watering actions that are planned under dry conditions are able to be achieved this year. And we have enough water to be able to carry over for our critical watering actions in 2019-20 as well.
So you can achieve what you want to do in a dry year. You've got the water you want for next year, so now you have some to sell.
That's correct. And we're able to make some of this water available for sale, largely because some of the water we committed to bird breeding in the Barmer Forest this year wasn't required. The birds didn't breed as we had anticipated they might, and so some of that water is up for sale.
So because that event didn't happen as you planned it, you don't need that water?
Correct.
So how is this sale process going to take place? How much are you selling?
We're selling 10,000 megalitres of Murray allocation in the Victorian Trading Zone 6 and 7. And we will use independent brokers to put the water onto the market.
So through a tender process?
Yes.
Yeah. And then people can buy the water on the market through those brokers and their platforms. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So there's a number of market intermediaries and mechanisms, and the water will be available and people can buy it from the water market.
You're selling it all in one hit?
No, we typically break it up into smaller lots. We'll be working through that process with the brokers.
How much money do you expect to make from a sale of this much water? And what do you do with that?
It would depend on how much the market is willing to pay. Over the past 7 days, prices have been at about $465 per megalitre. And so from the proceeds of that sale, the revenue will be invested in projects that will boost native fish populations in northern Victoria. Obviously, we've all been devastated by the fish deaths that have occurred in the Darling River in New South Wales. And we also want to play our part to help fish populations in that southern connected Murray-Darling Basin. And that will be through things like investing in fishways or fish habitat.
So we're talking, there's the potential of $4 to $5 million worth of revenue here. Is that ring-fenced to be used by only the View, or does that go back to the government?
For the Victorian Environmental Water Holder, and we'll be making a decision on what projects we will invest it into in those northern Victorian regions. By making the water available now, this is going to help meet some of the demand for autumn irrigation and irrigation carryover into next year. So we are aware that the current market conditions are challenging for many buyers. So that's why this really is a win-win for the environment and for regional communities by us putting the water onto the market at this time of year.
Yeah, so by selling it now, you're helping irrigators plan for their next sort of 6 to 12 months.
That's right. And if we sold it in a couple of months, it wouldn't be as useful to those farmers as it would be by putting it onto the market now.
And do you, in terms of the sale process, do you pick winners in the sense of where you sell the water and where it can go, or do you just leave that up to the rules of the market?
To the rules of the market. The Minister for Water has set out rules around how the Victorian Environmental Water Holder can make decisions, including about water trade. And in setting those rules, the government has ensured that the Victorian Environmental Water Holder is trading only in the public interest and in order to protect environmental values without adverse community impacts.
Do you expect to be selling more water this season, or will this be it?
In our trading strategy that we release each year, we had indicated that a trade in the north was possible. This is the trade that's occurring. Given our current supply-demand analysis, this will probably be the only trade in the north that we will make in the coming months, but we continuously re-look at our supply and demand as the weather conditions may change.
That's Serena Liu, Co-Executive Officer of the Victorian Environmental Water Holder, speaking with Warwick Long.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 18 past 12. Well, scientists say that fruit flies are becoming more resistant to common insecticides. The research team from the University of Melbourne found while temperate fruit flies, like those found in Victoria, were building a resistance, tropical fruit flies are becoming more susceptible to insecticides. Lead researcher Andre Fournier-Level says insecticides are becoming less effective.
They're evolving under multiple stresses, so that's not only insecticide or temperature or humidity. They have to cope with all the stresses all at once. And what was interesting is to know whether they could cope with that many pressures all at once.
And it seems like they can.
Yes and no. Yes, we have identified footprints that they have evolved under both thermotolerance stress and also insecticide resistant stress. But what we've also seen is that the regions that seem to have responded in the past to thermotolerance, which is one of the main thing a fly needs to do, complete its life cycle despite whatever external temperature there is, However, these regions that confer increased thermotolerance also did not help the fly to resist new insecticide pressure.
So fruit flies do seem to be evolving to resist insecticides. How does a fly evolve to resist insecticides?
Well, there's multiple mechanisms involved. First, it's a game between a bait and a target. So an insecticide being a bait and its molecular target being generally located somewhere in the fly's brine. And the first and most common mechanism is that the target changes its shape and the insecticide can no longer reach the target. However, another big mechanism that we've seen at play is detoxifying enzymes, which act as annihilate the insecticide before it reaches its target.
So does this mean that it's becoming more and more difficult to, I guess, control fruit fly numbers?
Oh, definitely. Like, it's particularly difficult to do so because, in fact, the second resistance mechanism, so that story of detoxifying enzymes, in fact, they're more general than one insecticide. Once they have evolved against one insecticide, they can relatively rapidly evolve against a second, a third, or a fourth insecticide.
So if fruit flies are evolving to be able to resist insecticides, then what can, I guess, agriculturalists and other people do to try and control the numbers?
Well, control the numbers first relies on an integrated pest management system, which means like use more than one tool. And basically what is definitely over is this area that kind of started in the 40s, where we could just use one barrel of chemical product to actually deal with any and every species. Now we have to evolve in a world where we need to apply a rational and use what we know. So typically, if we know that flies having to resist high temperature cannot evolve resistance, maybe we can use this pattern of thermotolerance to actually, in years where temperature is hot, let natural selection select for high temperature adapted flies that would not be insecticide resistant, and therefore we could diminish the levels of resistance in the population. That's an example.
Almost using ecological and climatic
Absolutely.
Factors.
Two things, yes. Ecological barriers, that's one thing, and then genomic conflict. So once we figure out what is the actual molecular mechanism at the gene level that confers one thing or the other, play one against the other, absolutely.
That's Professor Alexander Fournier-Level from the University of Melbourne speaking with Gary John Lysart.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Where it is 22 past 12. Well, the booming market for hemp seed in Australia has spurred on a new wave of growers in Tasmania. The state already produces almost two-thirds of the nation's commercial hemp crop. That figure may now grow on the back of increased demand and a supply shortage in mainland Australia. Larissa Smith spoke with a few of the industry's newest entrants.
At Campbelltown in Tasmania's northern Midlands, the harvester is slowly mowing down David Taylor's hemp crop. It's separating the oil-rich seed out of the hemp heads. Now, the crop itself is nearly 2 metres tall, so it's a slow process.
It's the first time I've grown. It is reasonably even. It's probably a little bit higher than I was expecting. I was hoping to try and keep the height down a little bit just to make harvesting more consistent and less stubble to deal with.
So as a first-time grower and looking to be part of the industry long-term, how important is it to a rotation to have those options?
Obviously, potatoes and poppies have been part of the Tasmania's cropping backbone for a long time, as well as the cereal crops, but I prefer the livestock poppy mix. But this one, I think, given the short growing season, it does work with my livestock operation reasonably well. So from that point of view, I think it's quite positive. And that's for me personally, but the agricultural industry in Tasmania, economically, I think another option for growers out there that gives them access to new markets on the mainland. And I know that Tasmania is this clean, green food image. I think this product works in pretty well with that too.
In the southern Midlands at York Plains, wool grower Stuart Burberry has also planted hemp for the first time.
It fitted the bill pretty well into our rotation, so yeah, we've got a winter feed gap out in our area, and the hemp fits in well because we can winter sheep on the ground and then spray the ground out and put it in October, November, and yeah, it works well that way.
When did it go in?
20th of November, off the top of my head, yeah, roundabout date. So yeah, went in then, and we just direct drilled into an oat stubble, into pretty good moisture, and didn't irrigate for about the first 5 weeks, but then yeah, it progressively got a bit drier the season, and well, we've put about 1.8 meg to the hectare on this crop, so yeah, it's come out pretty well.
What are the gross margins? What are the returns that you're hoping to get from this crop to make money from it more than just break even?
Yeah, well, we're contracted at $3.10 a kilo. Yeah, overheads are looking at probably somewhere around about the $1,300 to $1,400 a hectare to grow. So, yeah, we'd like to be netting a couple of hectare out of it, a couple of grand a hectare. So, yeah, if it can do that, we'll definitely keep going with it. We need to get more hectares of ground to have a really viable industry. And if we can get enough hectares, we'll get a good market for the residue products out of it. So, yeah, if we can find a good market for the residue and remove the residue off our paddocks, well, that'll be a big plus for everyone, I think.
This year I've been in every paddock that I've contracted every week, so it's been a little bit hectic driving between York Plains and Smithton every week.
Ted Jones is with Red Agriculture. It's a new company that's contracting growers on behalf of Geelong-based manufacturer Australian Primary Hemp.
Met a lovely group of farmers that are very proactive and wanting to grow more crops and find something that's going to fit into their rotation.
How much more hemp seed would they like out of Tasmania?
They would love to be able to achieve somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 tonnes, which would equate to around 2,000 hectares.
That's the total amount of hectares that I think the industry collectively would like to grow next season.
Yes, at the moment the demand for Australian-grown hemp seed far outstrips the supply. So regardless of what company's growing it, the demand for Australian grain is very high.
That's Ted Jones from Red Agriculture, ending that report from Larissa Smith.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It's 27 past 12. Well, the hazelnut industry, like many in agriculture, is facing its challenges at the moment, and it's one we've already mentioned today. A lack of water is hampering efforts for growers to meet what is an increasing demand for the nut. And it's while it's estimated that 170 tonnes are currently grown in Australia, a shortage means that there's a reliance on using imported hazelnuts, the majority of which come from Turkey. Vanessa and Clem Cox grow around 3,000 hazelnut trees in Mudgee in New South Wales. They say this year has been their most challenging yet because of the drought.
We typically get growers who will put in maybe 1,000 trees a year until they reach their target area. And a lot of them have either said, sorry, can't do it this year, we're running out of water, or they've halved their order.
So how much water do hazelnut trees need?
Probably more than people think. We used to put on about 15 litres a day. In hindsight, that probably wasn't enough. The trees were growing slowly. The nuts are born on one-year-old wood, so you really want to see a metre to half a metre of growth every year because that's where your crop's produced.
That's a lot of water at the moment, isn't it?
If we're going to get a crop, we've got to do it. And it's taking a lot of work, it's taking a lot of fuel and a lot of cost this year because we just haven't had the rain to supplement the irrigation at all.
What impact does a lack of water have on hazelnut growers?
The kernel doesn't fill in the shell. So you get a shriveled kernel, which is, you've got to downgrade it. The only thing you can do with it is roast it and turn it into crumb, but you can't present it to people. They don't like it. It doesn't taste right or anything else. And it's dry. A lot of times it's hard. It's a useless nut, really.
Vanessa, how strong is the hazelnut industry in Australia at the moment?
It's still a very small industry, but I would say that we are becoming very strong. We've got a bunch of very committed growers and good leadership. And of course, the other thing that happened during the last 4 or 5 years was that Ferrero became the major investor in the Australian hazelnut industry, which has created a lot of interest. And it's shown that hazelnuts can be grown in areas where traditionally we thought it was too hot.
Do we know roughly how many growers there are in Australia?
I'd say we'd be over 500 by now.
Is it a difficult nut to grow?
When you first plant them, they're quite easy because you just let them go. You leave them alone for 18 months to establish themselves and everything else. You just water them, give them a bit of tender, loving care, and that's it. But after that, then you've got to start training them and take the suckers off. The suckers are the biggest problem because they'll always sucker. They're not so much as a tree but a bush. In America, and previously most growers in Australia have grown on a single trunk, which means removing all the suckers all the time, whereas I'm leaning towards the Italian way, the European way, which is multiple trunks up to five trunks. The tree seems to grow a lot better, and it's a lot easier to train than a single trunk tree.
With the current conditions where there is a lack of water, what is the impact going to be on the industry if people aren't able to grow as many hazelnuts as they have in the past?
It means that we'll lose a lot of clients, yeah. And then we'll have to build that clientele back up again once we can start growing them again once the drought breaks. That's the biggest problem, is the clientele. We could sell, and I'm not joking, we could sell 500 tonnes a year easily if we had them. We get a lot of requests for hazelnuts, not just in Australia but overseas as well. You get ridiculous things, you know, you get emails from Russia and they want five container loads and things like that of, you know, 150 tonnes of nuts, kernel. It's just not available in Australia.
So there's no issue with demand, but there are supply issues at the moment?
Oh yeah, big supply issues, yeah. There's no issue with demand whatsoever. It's only trying to get the commercial grower to grow them. That's the biggest issue. For some reason, they've looked at hazelnuts over the years and have said no, where they've gone into almonds, they've gone into walnuts, pecans, pistachios, but they've left the hazelnuts out for some reason, and yet the hazelnuts probably produce quicker than most of the other varieties.
Could we be seeing a shortage in Australian hazelnuts and we may have to rely more on hazelnuts from overseas?
Certainly. If this drought continues on, yes. We'll be seeing a lot of shortage in a lot of stuff, I'd reckon.
That's Clem Cox, hazelnut grower from Mudgee, speaking with Tim Fuchs. It is a 29-1 on the Country Hour. Time to get the latest in news headlines now with Simon Glatter. Afternoon, Simon.
Good afternoon, Nikolai. Out-of-control bushfires at Dargo and Lacola in Victoria's east have burnt more than 110,000 hectares. About 400 firefighters from Victoria, Interstate and New Zealand are using dozers and aircraft to contain the fires. The Dargo Road into town has been reopened, but roads north of Dargo remain closed. A former Catholic priest has been remanded in custody after pleading guilty to historical child sexual offences in Western Victoria. 70-year-old Paul David Ryan pleaded guilty to the indecent assault of two boys under the age of 16 and one boy under the age of 18 between 1981 and 1992. The county court heard the offences took place in Ararat, Warrnambool and Lower Plenty. Police have confirmed the person killed in a single vehicle crash near Kerrang yesterday morning was the sole occupant in the car. The car was being driven along the Murray Valley Highway before crashing into a tree, bursting into flames. The driver is yet to be formally identified. The state government is urging vulnerable groups, including the elderly and very young, to get their flu vaccinations from the end of this month. There's already been just under 3,000 cases of influenza this year in Victoria, more than double the number recorded by Vic Health last year. And the organisers of the Rainbow Serpent Music Festival in Western Victoria hope to continue the event for at least another 20 years. The current planning policies that allow the event to use the Jack Smith's Lane site at Lexton are due to expire after 2020. The Pyrenees Council will discuss the matter tonight. And for more news, you can visit our website, abc.net.au/news.
Thanks so much, Simon Galetta there with news headlines. Now let's head off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Senior forecaster Richard Carline is on duty. Afternoon, Richard.
Good afternoon, Nikolai.
I gather there are some rainfall figures on offer.
Yes, but the biggest ones are in the very far east of the state. Mm. We've had fairly solid rain out there for 36 hours. The last 24 hours, combined bar 70 millimetres, Mount Elizabeth 60, down to 22 at Orbost, 9 at Bairnsdale and 4 at Sale. So it just shows how it tails off the further west you went. And the main rain was into the hills rather than on the coast. That meant for the 48 hours, combined bars had 115 millimetres, the only one to make it to three figures. Orbost has had 43, Cairn River 41, Bairnsdale 10. There's been some falls in the West Gippsland Highlands of around 10 to 20 millimetres, but not too much further south over West Gippsland. And all other districts have been dry. There may have been some drizzle out over the Western or Central District this morning, but not enough to measure 0.2 millimetres. And that's the state of play at the moment, with a fairly consistent humid southeasterly airstream continuing. Now, the east coast low, that brought that rain to East Gippsland, that heavier rain. That's weakened and moved northward and is out of the vicinity. So we still do have some showers streaming into Gippsland, but they're much more isolated than they were before. So the highest rain is behind us now, but we'll still have scattered showers and the chance of isolated thunderstorms in Gippsland today, mainly over East Gippsland. Elsewhere, we're looking at dry conditions. Low cloud in the southwest and central district is slowly burning off, but we should see some sunny periods there. The north is mainly sunny. And temperatures heading up towards the low 30s in the north, topping out at 35 degrees at Mildura, around the high 20s in the southwest, away from the coast. And the mid-20s in Gippsland with the heavier cloud cover, which should persist through the afternoon. So rainfall totals outside thunderstorms are just likely to be 2 to 10 millimetres, I think, in East Gippsland now. We're certainly past the heaviest rainfall. But not much change tomorrow. Still some showers in Gippsland, mainly East Gippsland, with a chance of isolated thunderstorms. Some morning drizzle possible in the southwest and central district, and fine over the northern plains, and similar temperatures, still low to mid 30s over the north and the mid to high 20s over the south. No change really for Thursday either, still that onshore humid southeasterly airstream, so we'll see a few more showers in Gippsland with a chance of isolated thunderstorms about the ranges, and generally fine elsewhere apart from morning drizzle in the southwest and also about the central district. But on Friday, a low pressure trough will develop over Western Victoria. That will allow the winds to turn warmer northerly. So it looks like that will be the hottest day this week on Friday. Temperatures up to 37, 38 degrees at Mildura and Swan Hill. Mid-30s for remaining northern areas and nudging 30 degrees in the south. Again, it looks like the main activity will be about the eastern ranges with some isolated showers and thunderstorms there. Elsewhere, it should be mostly fine. Heading into the weekend, that low pressure trough moves eastwards across the state. That will bring some cooler southwesterly winds. We'll see a few showers and thunderstorms about, mainly over central and eastern areas. That's ahead of that low pressure trough. Sunday looks like mainly fine conditions, although a vigorous cold front will be approaching the west later in the day, and that front will move through early Monday, bringing gusty southwesterly winds, cooler airstream. A few showers mainly in the south. At this stage, it doesn't look like we'll see too many showers over the north of the state. So this warm spell will come to an end, I think, during the weekend, and then quite a cool start to next week with temperatures dipping to the mid to high teens in the south.
Okay, thank you very much, Richard.
Thanks, Nikolai.
Richard Carline, senior forecaster on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology. Just a reminder, too, that there remains a watch and act message for a bushfire at Rose River. The Dandongadale-Macready track fire is not yet under control. The fire is 1,290 hectares in size. It's burning within established control lines in public and private forest, and crews will be continuing with backburning operations today to secure control lines, and that may lead to an increase in smoke in the area. You can find more details at emergency.vic.gov.au.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It's 21 to 1. My name's Nikolai Bailharts. Australian Wool Innovation CEO Stuart McCulloch says the organisation is negotiating with industry, despite not holding a previously promoted extraordinary general meeting, which had been planned for last week. The Wool Research and Development Organisation has been criticised for not implementing all the recommendations from a large review last year. Industry discussions mean all but one of the recommendations have been agreed to by other industry organisations. Stuart McCulloch spoke to Cassie Huff at the South Australian Stud Merino Breeders Expo.
The board has worked very hard with industry over the last 4 months to bring them together and work with them to see whether we could avoid an EGM, firstly because of the cost, and secondly because we really wanted a consensus amongst them as to these resolutions. So there is one outstanding that at the moment, and we'll continue to work with industry to see whether we can solve that and put that with their blessing, with our blessing, to an EGM.
And that one that's outstanding, I believe, is related to the tenure of board members. What is the sticking point there?
Oh, look, it's a discussion that we're continuing on at the moment. I won't go into the details of that, but you know, there's going to have to be flexibility on both sides, and we're quite willing to do that. And the industry's shown that they're flexible too. So you know, we'll nut this out, and I'm confident that we can get to a point where we have something that can go to all growers with the blessing of you know, the directors of our company and the directors of their companies, the industry companies, and it gets through.
The couple of other things were more transparency on proxy voting and capping board tenure and the director and things like that. Are you announcing what those decisions that you've come to with those grower groups are at this stage for those five outstanding recommendations?
Yeah, we'll make that all available pretty soon.
Because transparency has been a bit of a criticism of AWI in the past.
Yeah, look, we've heard that. We certainly, that's what it, the review of performance went into in great depth. We've heard that. We've been, you know, as I said, working really hard with industry over the last 4 months. We've been open, transparent, listening, consultative. So, look, they're all been exactly the same. So we're delighted about that, and we'll continue to work with them. It's an ongoing thing, and we don't expect it to stop this month or next month or in 6 months. It's going to continue to require discussion, and you know, we'll get there.
The Ernst & Young review was called by Minister Littleproud, and the subsequent recommendations that you're working on now were part of that review. The Minister did call for all 82 of the recommendations to be acted on. The fact that this hasn't come to fruition, is this largely a slap in the face to the Minister?
Oh, no, definitely not. And we've kept the Minister and the Department, you know, fully engaged on this, fully apprised of the process. You know, the Minister also asked us and the industry to show leadership. And, you know, we think that that's largely come about, you know, that we've worked hard with industry. You know, we have gone to him with industry and explained the situation. So, no, I think that, you know, this is just a process that you've got to step through, and I think he accepts that and is glad we're doing it.
By not implementing the full 82 recommendations, though, are you risking the joint funding from the government, the funds, the 13 million odd funds that the government contribute?
No, I don't believe so. You know, as I said, the Minister asked for leadership and consultation and discussion, and that's what we've done, and he's aware of that. So I think that's not an option.
Have you spoken to him, though, about this decision now not to hold an EGM?
Yes, we have.
Do you have any concerns going forward? A lot of people brought their shearings forward to have some cash flow this year. As you had said, there's not a lot of lambs on the ground. Are you foreseeing any sort of quality or supply issues in the next 6 months to a year?
Certainly supply, you know, there's no doubt about that.
Well, I'm meaning pushback from buyers as a result of the lower quality and the lower, what, due to breakage, etc., due to nutrition issues.
No, it all sells. every kilogram sells every year, so it's not what sells, it's what it sells at. So, you know, look at it, and it's all converted into beautiful wool garments. So, you know, I know a lot of people get, you know, punch at shadows around these things, but, you know, all wool's good wool, irrespective of, you know, what part of the animals come off. It all sells, and it's all got a home eventually in a commercial retail garment.
Australian Wool Innovation CEO Stuart McCulloch speaking with Cassie Huff. The peak representative group for the Australian wool industry, Wool Producers Australia, has said that it is pleased that the wool industry will avoid that extraordinary general meeting.
You're listening to the Country Hour. on ABC Radio Victoria.
16 to 1. Well, carrots remain the star performer when it comes to Australian vegetable exports, hitting almost $100 million worth last year. AusVeg has just released data on vegetable exports for 2018 and says Singapore, Japan and Thailand have all seen significant growth. Interestingly, though, China has not. Michael Coote is National Manager of Export Developments with AusVeg.
We are really encouraged to see that there's been some strong growth across a number of different Asian and Middle Eastern markets, but also a number of different vegetable products or commodities that are grown across the country have seen some really positive growth.
Where are you seeing the biggest growth occur?
Well, for the first time, we've sold over $50 million worth of Australian fresh vegetables into Singapore, which is up about 7.5% on 2017. But we're seeing really positive growth in a number of Asian markets, such as Japan, Malaysia, Hong Kong, and some Southeast Asian countries. And also there's some consistent growth in some of the traditional Middle Eastern markets for products like carrots out of Western Australia.
Well, on that note, broadly speaking, which crops are performing the best or are kind of growing the most when it comes to exports?
For fresh vegetable exports, carrots remain the dominant, I guess, vegetable export crop. Just under $100 million worth of carrots were exported out of Australia last year and about 113,000 tonnes. So that's up about 7% on the previous year. We've seen some really positive growth in 2018, particularly in the second half of the year in potatoes and onions. So potatoes have bounced back from a relatively soft 2017 export year to be up about 27% in value to $32 million worth of Australian potato exports and up 28% in volume to about 40,000 tonnes. Onions have seen some similar positive growth figures, up around 25% in value to $24 million and around 34,000 tonnes of Australian onions exported to different Asian, Middle Eastern and European markets.
So do those products that have a longer shelf life kind of have an inherent advantage here? Because obviously time can be one of the challenges when you're exporting, I guess, more of the kind of leafy green veg. If you're talking carrots, onions, potatoes, they can tend to last a bit longer.
Yeah, look, carrots, onions and potatoes are traditionally sea freighted to a lot of markets and they do have, as you pointed out, longer shelf life than some of the more perishable products. However, we are seeing some strong growth figures for other crops that are air freighted, like broccoli and cauliflowers, celery and even leafy salads, which are traditionally air freighted to some of the closer, I guess, Asian and Middle Eastern markets. But broccoli and cauliflower as a category was up about 30% to 8,500 tonnes and $22 million last year. So that's come off a relatively low base about 4 or 5 years ago to be one of our more meaningful vegetable export crops.
Now, you've mentioned a number of Asian countries which have been some of the big growth markets, so Singapore, Japan, Thailand, those kinds of places. I noticed that China is not on that list and we hear so much about the opportunities of China. Why isn't China featuring on these lists?
Currently for fresh vegetables, we don't have very strong market access for a number of different Australian vegetable crops. We do send small amounts of asparagus into China, but one thing we've got to keep in mind is that, you know, China is a big producer of vegetables, so they do have a very high domestic self-sufficiency rate for their fresh vegetable consumption. So given the current lack of access into China, as an industry, we're focusing on trying to develop the markets where we do have access and really capture some of the latent demand that does exist across Asia and the Middle East.
And you make the interesting point about vegetables as a, broadly speaking, as a sector of agriculture being, you know, relatively low value and obviously high labour costs here in Australia as well. So it's interesting that it does make economic sense to be exporting, that it is worth it.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Nikolai. But one of the benefits that the Australian vegetable industry has got over some of our competitors is that we do produce most vegetable crops year-round. Australia is a large country, as we all know, with diverse growing regions around the country. So that allows us to supply into different markets year-round where there is that opportunity, or to fill seasonal windows when local production or other competitor countries are not supplying into that market. So, you know, for growers in our industry, understanding where those seasonal windows do exist in different markets for different different crops, and then being able to fill that demand is one of the things that really allows us to compete on an international stage.
And you spoke earlier about that idea of trying to, I guess, kind of expand on some of the these markets. How important is it to physically be on the ground in those markets? Do you need a physical presence there these days if you're thinking of exporting, or can you do it all kind of online and on the phone?
Look, nothing beats that face-to-face interaction, and AusVeg, in partnership with Hort Innovation, have continued to invest in export development for the vegetable industry, and one key element of that is a range of market development activities, taking growers into market to either exhibit at trade shows or to meet face-to-face with importers and retailers in their home market and build understanding of local supply chains, and also the flip side of that, which is bringing buyers into Australia to showcase Australia's high-quality local production and really demonstrate to them what underpins that clean and green image that Australian fresh produce does have in international markets.
And just finally, we've spoken a lot on the country about the tough season for many sectors of ag, and obviously veggies has been included in that. A lot of people either facing drought or flood, depending on where you are in Australia. Are you expecting that could have the potential to affect upcoming export figures?
Look, I hope not, but it certainly will be a factor, I think, Nikolai. When we've got inclement weather or different conditions that means that yields drop, then that will have an impact on vegetable exports. But one thing when we're looking at the whole vegetable category is that every year, depending on different either weather or market conditions and different market dynamics, means that we'll see some crops might come off a little bit in terms of their export volumes, and some might increase. So when I'm looking at the 3 and 5 year trends of vegetable exports, we have been increasing from about 4 or 5 years ago. We were exporting around $150 to $170 million worth of product, and that's now up to $280. So the general trend is up, and I'm hopeful that will continue in the coming year, even with the potentially tough growing conditions ahead.
That's Michael Coote, National Manager of Export Developments with AusVeg. Well, speaking with exports, high hay prices and a lack of supply in Australia are pushing the lucrative Chinese market to look elsewhere for fodder. Andrew Bolt heads up Major Exporter Hay Australia, which has processing facilities in Western Australia and in Central Victoria. He says there has been a sharp drop-off in exports to China.
Well, if you look at the statistics for exports out of different markets, over the last 12 months, Australia's been sending around 20 to 25,000 tonnes a month of hay to the Chinese market. And January, it was down to 11,000 tonnes.
So how big's the Chinese market compared to other markets?
Chinese market's the second biggest market for Australian-owned hay currently, after Japan.
The decrease into January this year, that's purely because of the higher price of hay?
Look, I would think that's probably the main reason. There's certainly been very large shortfall of hay caused by the seasonal conditions. So, we've probably slowed down our production and concentrated on customers that, were prepared to pay, the market price that we needed to reflect, value back to our growers.
So China's been a rapidly growing market for Australian hay exports. Are you able to explain a little bit about that?
So we exported our first shipment to China in around 2011, and the market didn't really start significant shipments until maybe 2013. The market's grown from around 30,000 tonnes in 2013 to last year being very close to 300,000 tonnes in a period of 5-6 years. The market's grown considerably.
Is there a risk Chinese buyers may not return to Australian oat and hay after this year, it being so expensive?
There's always that risk. The customers, they're going to be looking at all their feed ingredients, and they're trying to get a ration that works for the health and productivity of their animals. Oat and hay doesn't need to be a part of that ration, but we obviously believe that it is a really good part of the ration. And from Australia, we've got a really good reputation of reliability and sustainability of supply. But when they do look at alternates and they reformulate rations, maybe they decide that they can use less oat and hay in their ration or use an alternate.
So what does all this mean for those at the farm gate, those who grow the hay that gets exported?
the market for Iden hay out of Australia is strong and it's been growing over a number of years. The whole market has grown from something, you know, under 100,000 tonnes to currently 1.2 million tonnes was exported last year. And so the demand for the product is firm and it's strong. You know, I think the demand for good quality hay is always there. You know, seasonal conditions in the eastern states last year, this year, you know, what the future's like, that we know that the overall amount of hay left in sheds or, you know, there's going to be, we're going to be starting new season, so October, November this year, with not much hay around at all. So I think the forecast for the, you know, for the next 12 months, you know, that there's definitely going to be some really good demand for Iden hay. It does open the door to alternate suppliers, and you're starting to see countries like Sudan, Argentina, Bulgaria, Spain, they're increasing their export markets, and the US is the biggest supplier on the world market. Australia is the second largest, but you're starting to see significant amounts of hay being traded out of countries like Spain. The Middle Eastern countries have invested in North Africa as a supply region, and recently the Chinese have gone to Sudan and been buying alfalfa out of there to meet some of their requirements. Fodder is truly it's a globally traded product, and increasingly there's new entrants to the market, and it is something that obviously us as Australian exporters, we need to keep a close eye on what that competitive environment's like and how it is changing. And, you know, we need to put a lot of time and effort into our marketing and into promoting our product and making sure that Iden hay, Australian Iden hay, is the product that customers want to come and buy.
That's Andrew Bolt, his Managing Director of Hay Australia, speaking there with Simone Smith. That does mean it's time to head off to the livestock markets, starting today at Shepparton with Nicole Varley.
Afternoon, well, the numbers dropped here. We had 600 exports and 500 trade cattle penned. It was a rare sight to see as Friesian cows were scarce this week. Prices jumped across the steer grades, including the Friesian bullocks, which lifted by 15 to 25 cents on those Friesian steers. With some rain up north, increased exporter interest to secure finished cattle for a northern plant saw competition lift. Trade cattle quality remains mixed, but the supplementary fed stock and good vealers also jumped in prices today. Vealers range from 260 to 317, yearling steers 267 to 307, yearling heifers 226 to 275 cents. The 400 to 500 kilo steers 268 to 293, averaging around 278. 500 to 600 kilo steers made to 290. 600 kilo plus bullocks make to 289. The Friesian steers 191 to 240. Beef cows 170 to 185 cents. And the heavy dairy cows 122 to 177. This is Nicole Varley from Shepparton.
Thanks, Nicole. Now to Ballarat and Graham Palmer.
Good afternoon, everyone. With 15,600 lambs yarded, that was a similar Ballarat this week. Quality range from average to good, with a regular buying group operating selectively in a slightly dearer market on the lighter lambs and around firm on the trade in heavyweight lambs. Heavy lambs reach 175, medium weights 22 to 24 kg, sold from 150 to 169.50. There were few heavy and extra heavy lambs through the yarding. Restockers and feeders paid from 105 to 143. Lighter lots made from 36 to 90. Heavy restocker lambs sold at 170. It's about 8,700 sheep still to be sold. The light trade weight 18 to 22 kg lambs sold from 127 to 158, average around 680. Medium trade weights 22 to 24, sold from 150 to 169.50, and average around 660. Exports reinforced score 26 to 30 kilo lambs sold from 162 to 175. Heavy hoggets made to 147. There's about 8,700 sheep still to be sold. Graham Pyme at Ballarat from LA.
Thanks, Graham. And now to Wodonga and Leanne Dax.
Numbers fell back with agents yarding just over 600 cattle. Quality was quite good for trade and heavy exports, along with a mixed selection of secondary types. The best of the veal held firm to 4 cents dearer, 262 to $3.40. Trade steers slipped back 20 cents, only due to the limited supply of supplementary fed, 265 to 310. Feeder steers jumped 24 cents for the medium weights, 262 to 272, with the lighter weights topping at 257. Feeder heifers jumped 40, 204 to 255. Trade heifers gained 11 cents, 249 to 276. Grown steers and bullocks lifted 25 cents, 262 to 275. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks very much, Leanne. And that is pretty much it for the Country Hour for today. Remember, you can find all of our stories up online at our website. That address, abc.net.au/rural. It is 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.